The subject of my talk is going to be the collection of the Quran. We're going to have a look at how the book was originally compiled after Muhammad's death. But perhaps one has to begin with the Muslim attitude to the compilation of the Quran before we look at it from a historical perspective. The reason I say this is because Muslims worldwide believe to this day that the Quran is perfect, that it has been transcribed just as it was revealed. And the conviction seems to be that if it was revealed from heaven originally in a perfect form, then Allah must have preserved it equally perfectly. And one finds, for example, Muhammad Hussein Haykal saying in his book, The Life of Muhammad, the purity of the Quranic text is and will forever remain the greatest miracle of all history. So there is a conviction in his writings and in those of others that the Quran has been preserved absolutely pure and entire, virtually down to the last vowel point. From a Christian perspective, this attitude is important because Muslims generally use it to reflect on what they believe is a corrupted Bible. Muslims find that here and there in the Bible there are variant readings, mainly in the New Testament. There are one or two passages, I think in fact only two, whose origin is uncertain. From a Christian perspective, these things are not really important because these passages in the Bible put together wouldn't fill more than two or three pages, and the Bible is well over 1,000 pages long. But nonetheless, Muslims are convinced that this proves that the Bible has been changed, and they say our Quran is perfect, and so as a result they suggest that this proves that the Quran is the Word of God. Islam has never been through what we call in the Christian world scientific or historical criticism. In the case of the Bible, scholars have examined the book objectively in terms of its historicity, and as a result of this, we have the records of the variant readings, which are usually recorded as footnotes in most translations, particularly English translations of the Bible. But in Islam, there has never been, in all Muslim history, a time where the Quran has been subjected to any kind of critical analysis. It is just widely assumed that the book must be perfect because it is believed to be the Word of God. We are going to apply a process of critical analysis to the early records of how the Quran was compiled to see whether the Quran really has been preserved, as is suggested, or whether rather there was a development, different stages in the development of the text, which brought it down into the form in which we have it today. And I'm going to begin with looking at the state of the Quran at the end of Muhammad's life. It is a well-known fact that during his lifetime, the Quran was never officially completed. In fact, it could not have been, because as long as Muhammad was alive, there was always the possibility that further passages would be added to the text as it already existed. In fact, there are certain traditions in Islam that say that the greatest part of the Quran was revealed just before he died. And the Quran was eventually completed not by a decree of Allah, nor by any statement in the book itself to the effect that that was it, nothing more was to be expected. Rather, the Quran was completed pure and simply by the death of Muhammad. Once the recipient was no longer alive, there was no longer a possibility of any additional passages. And we know also from the records of Islam, the early historical records, what are generally known as the hadith literature, that the Quran had never been compiled into a single book form by the end of Muhammad's life. In fact, it was only after his death that it was first collected into a single form, into what is called in Arabic records a Mushaf Wahid, a single manuscript. If we look at the hadith of Sahih al-Bukhari, and we turn to the English translation of it, in volume 6 and page 477, we find that Zayd ibn Thabit stated, shortly after Muhammad's death, that Abu Bakr, that was Muhammad's first successor, his first Khalifa, sent for me when the people of Yamama had been killed. That was a battle that was fought shortly after Muhammad's death when a number of the Qura, a number of the reciters of the Quran had been killed. And there was a concern on his part, on Abu Bakr's part, that the Quran might be lost. So he called Zayd, and Zayd was known to be an authority on the Quran, and he said, "You are a wise young man. We do not have any suspicion about you. And you used to write the inspiration for Allah's apostle, divine inspiration as Muslims believe it. So he said, you should search for the Quran and collect it," meaning into one book. And Zayd's reaction was to take exception. He said, "By Allah, if they had ordered me to shift a mountain, it would not have been heavier for me than ordering me to collect the Quran." And I said to Abu Bakr, "How will you do something which Allah's apostle did not do?" Abu Bakr replied, "By Allah, it is a good project." The one thing that is clearly stated in this passage is that the collection of the Quran is something which Allah's apostle did not do during his lifetime. But there were certain men who were regarded during his life as being authorities on the text of the Quran, and some of them are named in this same book, volume 6 of the Sahih of al-Bukhari, page 488. And the names of the four given here who were authorities are Ubay ibn Ka'b, two others, and Zayd ibn Thabit. And I mention them because I'll come back to Ubay as well as to Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, who is mentioned in another similar text. Well, no one, as far as we know, knew the Quran absolutely perfectly at the end of Muhammad's life. If any one of these men did know it off by heart, the collection of the book would have been a simple matter. He could just simply have written it out and said, "There it is, word for word, dot for dot, and letter for letter." But that never happened, because Zayd, on the contrary, said, "I will have to search for the book," and he began to do so. And he said, "I looked for it. I searched for it on palm leaves." Parts of the Quran had been inscribed on the leaves of palms. "I searched for it on stones. I searched for it in the hearts of men." And in fact, we understand that most of the Quran as then known or recorded was in the memories of Muhammad's companions. That's why when so many of them were killed at the Battle of Yamama, that the order went out to Zayd to collect the Quran into a single manuscript. So he put the Quran together as best as he could. And one must note here that Zayd did not compile the Quran under any kind of divine supervision. It is not as though he was directed from heaven by an angel, by anyone else, to collect the Quran with the assurance that what came out would be perfect. It was one man, only a companion of Muhammad, not Muhammad himself, at his own discretion, who put the Quran together into the form in which we have it today. I've no doubt he did his best to be accurate as far as he could be. He certainly tried to get every text that he could. But we know that there are passages that were only found with one person. Zayd tells us in same book of Bukhari, page 478, "I found the last verse of Surah At-Tawbah," that's the chapter of repentance, "with Abu Khuzaimah al-Ansari, and I did not find it with anyone other than him." In another record in the Kitab al-Masahif of Ibn Abi Dawud, we are told that this Khuzaimah actually came to him, came to Zayd and said, "You've missed out a text which we used to recite during the time of the Prophet." And he gave him this passage and this text. And it was only because of this disclosure that Zayd included it. So you can see that the original collection of the Quran was not something that was done under divine supervision. It was purely an honest attempt, perhaps, but really just an attempt to collect the book into one copy, one manuscript, one mushaf, as far as the redactor possibly could. And this copy of Zayd's did not in fact become a standardized copy. It wasn't an official copy at all. In fact, it was kept in seclusion for many years. Abu Bakr died shortly after Muhammad. This copy then passed to Umar, second Khalifa, and on his death, instead of passing to Uthman, the third Khalifa, it was kept by Umar's daughter Hafsa in her private possession. In fact, there are records in the hadith that state that she in fact kept it concealed under a bed. And one hardly gets the impression that this manuscript of the Quran was in any way regarded as an official copy. It was just simply one that was written out and transcribed by the man Zayd for Abu Bakr, and there's no indication that it was ever intended to be used for the Muslim community as a whole. Therefore, it does not surprise us to find that there were a number of other companions, Sahaba of Muhammad, who were also writing out the Quran in their own way. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is known to be one of the people who wrote out a manuscript, a mushaf, a codex of the Quran. Ubay ibn Ka'b is another. There are many records of different companions of Muhammad who kept their own manuscripts, wrote out their own manuscripts. And particularly as Islam expanded, these various codices became useful as texts in the various provinces where Islam was becoming dominant. And as a result, Ibn Mas'ud's text became the official text of the Quran at Kufa in Iraq. Ubay ibn Ka'b, he moved into Syria. And in various parts of the Muslim world, as it was growing, different provinces, we found that these particular manuscripts of the different companions of Muhammad took on a sort of legitimate authority over the people there. And as a result, the particular writer of the Quran was regarded in high esteem, because if he knew Muhammad so well and he knew the Quran so well, he was regarded as a person of great leadership. And so the man had powerful influence over the community where he was. Well, we turn to the reign of Uthman to discover what happened next in the history of the text of the Quran. And we find that during a battle in what is now known as the Middle East, people came from the province of Kufa in Iraq and from other provinces in Syria, together Muslims, to fight the battle jointly. And they were astonished to find that the people of the one area were reciting the Quran differently to those from the other. And one man, Hudhayfa, was afraid of the people of Sham and the people of Iraq reading the Quran differently. And so we read in one of the works of Hadith that he was troubled by their differences in the recitation of the Quran. So he said to Uthman, "O chief of believers, save this nation before they differ about the book, that is the Quran, as Jews and the Christians did before." So Uthman, as a result of this, sent a message to Hafsa saying, "Send us the manuscripts of the Quran so that we may compile the Quranic materials in perfect copies and return the manuscripts to you." That comes from the Sahih of al-Bukhari, volume 6, page 479. And so we see that Uthman, the Khalif, now took the unusual step of calling for that one particular manuscript of the Quran that had been transcribed by Zayd ibn Thabit. And he now said that this particular manuscript should be transcribed. It should be written out into a number of different copies. I think in all there were seven. And these were to be sent to those different provinces. And the objective was to ensure that one standard uniform text of the Quran became used throughout the Muslim world, and at the same time to ensure that the control of Uthman from Medina would remain absolute, and that the other companions of Muhammad who had their own texts of the Quran would lose their influence. So we see that Uthman had a double purpose in mind when he ordered this manuscript of Zayd to become the official standard text of the Quran. The first was to do something about the growing influence of the Qurra, the reciters of the Quran who were getting so much influence among the people of the different provinces. And the second was to bring about what Ibn Abi Dawud calls the Mus'haf Wahid, the single manuscript, the one text, the uniform text for the whole Muslim community. Uthman had run into trouble because he had come from the Banu Umayya, who were a tribe in Mecca who had in fact opposed Muhammad quite strongly in his lifetime. Some of Muhammad's greatest enemies came from this sub-tribe. And Uthman was one of the very few to actually follow Muhammad and become one of his companions. But when Uthman became the Khalif of the Muslim world, he installed a number of these enemies of Muhammad or their descendants in key positions in the Muslim world. And as a result, the original companions of Muhammad were highly offended, and there was a real danger of a conspiracy against the Khalif. And it was a masterstroke on his part to order, as he did, the destruction of all these other codices that had become standard texts in the different parts of the Muslim world, and at the same time institute or impose the text of Zayd as the sole authentic text. That was a masterstroke because it ensured that these men would lose their influence. It was as if to say, your texts of the Quran are not as authoritative as the one we have at Medina, and the aim apparently was to undermine the power and the authority that these men had wherever they were established. But the other reason was, and one accepts this, to bring about a single text. But what we see here is not that the Quran was perfectly transcribed dot for dot, letter for letter, in one text, one single text at the beginning of Islam, even during the lifetime of Muhammad, but that Uthman took a particular action to standardize the text of the Quran. And the action he took was simply to order, as he does, that all the other Quranic materials, this is the same reference I gave earlier from Bukhari, all of the other Quranic materials, whether written in fragmentary manuscripts or in whole copies, be burnt. And that's just what happened to them. We read in certain parts of the hadith literature that Ibn Mas'ud was not keen to give up his text for destruction. Zayd was a young man when Muhammad came to Medina. And during Muhammad's time in Mecca, when Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was one of his closest followers, Zayd wasn't even a Muslim. And Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is recorded as saying, why should I give up my text to be destroyed in favor of one done by another man who was still in the loins of his mother when I already knew 70 chapters of the Quran off by heart? He said, I prefer to read the Quran according to the text of him whom I love the most, that was Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, rather than Zayd, which indicated that he didn't think too highly of Zayd's manuscript. But one must ask the question, why did Uthman choose Zayd's text of the Quran rather than the text of one of the other companions of Muhammad as the standard official text for the Muslim world? Did he think it was better, more authentic? Did he believe that this one was perfect and the others imperfect? We don't get that impression at all. The impression we get is that Uthman chose it purely because it was convenient for him to do so. Firstly, the text happened to be at hand. It was there in Medina. It was nearby. And it was useful to him to have a text at home rather than have to draw one from one of the provinces to be used as the standard text. He could thereby assert the authority of Medina over the general Muslim provinces again. And secondly, this text of Zayd had never been used anywhere in the Muslim world, with the result that it had not been subject to dispute as the others had. That didn't mean it was better. The only reason it hadn't been disputed about was simply because the text had been concealed. It hadn't become public knowledge. It had not been used as a standard text in any of the provinces. And so it wasn't known. There was no rivalry about it. It didn't represent a particular faction of the Muslim world. And so it was easy to bring this text out and say this was done by a companion of Muhammad, well-known authority on the Quran, done under the authority of Abu Bakr, and therefore it should become the standard text for the Muslim world. That was very convenient for him to do it like that. But nonetheless, that's how it happened. And as a result, this text became the standard text of the Quran for the Muslim world. Now the question is, why did he order these other manuscripts to be burnt? If they were authentic copies of the Quran, why go to so much trouble to order that they should be destroyed? As someone has said, the Christian world has never had an Uthman. No one in Christian history ever ordered that whole written manuscripts of Old and New Testament scriptures should be burnt. There must have been something radically different between the texts of Ibn Mas'ud and Ubay ibn Ka'b and Zayd ibn Thabit for such an order to go out. And one can only assume that they must have differed from each other considerably. To bring about that kind of uniformity, the differences between them must have been so serious as to call for this kind of action. And so one would expect to find that there were variant readings in these various texts. And that's just what we do find. None of the texts were preserved to our knowledge. So we don't have a manuscript showing how Ibn Mas'ud's text looked exactly, or that of Ubay ibn Ka'b or of any of the other companions. But nonetheless, records were kept of the differences of reading between the various manuscripts. Very careful records were kept. At-Tabari kept an extensive record in the commentary that he wrote on the Quran. So did Ibn Abi Dawud, who was the son of Abu Dawud, who wrote one of the major hadith works, Kitab as-Sunan. These men carefully preserved the differences of reading that existed between the different texts. In fact, Ibn Abi Dawud, in his book Kitab al-Masahif, writes that there were so many differences between that text of Ibn Mas'ud and the one of Zayd that the differences alone could fill no less than 19 pages of his book. He writes them out one by one and states what the differences were. He then goes on to the other manuscripts that were written out by other companions of Muhammad and lists the differences between them and the text of Zayd as well. And I am going to mention one or two of the variant readings that you find in this particular work of Ibn Mas'ud. But before I do, I'd like to tell you just something briefly about him. He was very, very highly regarded. Let me read that text to you more fully that I briefly mentioned earlier from the Sahih of al-Bukhari, volume 5, page 96. Masruk narrated, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was mentioned before Abdullah ibn Amr, who said, "That is a man I still love, because I heard the Prophet saying, learn the Quran from four people. From Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, he started with him. Then from Salim, the freed slave of Abu Hudayfa, and from two others." So according to this text from Bukhari, Muhammad deliberately started with Abdullah ibn Mas'ud in recommending people from whom the Quran should be learnt, which implies that he was, in Muhammad's eyes, the best authority on the Quran that existed in the Muslim world at his time. And when we look at him, we see that the man was a man of great character in Islam, great stature. He'd been with Muhammad from the very beginning almost. He was one of his earliest converts, and he became one of the leaders in the province of Iraq at Kufa after his death. But we find that he records a number of different texts where his varies from that of Zayd ibn Thabit. And we turn to three of them I'm going to give you just briefly to show exactly what the character of the differences were between his readings and those of Zayd. For example, we turn to Surah 2, verse 275, where you find the words, "People who devour interest or usury, riba, will not stand." And that's how the text reads. But Ibn Mas'ud's text, although it had the same words, added the expression yawm al-qiyamati. In other words, people who devour interest will not stand on the day of resurrection. That variant reading is mentioned by Abu Ubaid in his book, Kitab Fatayil al-Quran, the book on the excellences of the Quran. It's recorded in the Codex of Talha, secondary codex dependent on Ibn Mas'ud's text. So here you have an expression which is not just a pronunciation of a vowel point or anything like that. Rather, it's a clause, it's an extra set of words that was added to his text of this particular verse, which is not found in the Quran as we find it today. Then secondly, I move to Surah 6, verse 153, which begins with the words, وَأَنَّ هَذَا سِيرَتِي, verily this is my path. But Ibn Mas'ud's text, we learn from At-Tabari, read, وَحَذَا سِرَاتُ رَبَّكُمْ, this is the path of your Lord. And we find also that Ubay ibn Ka'b, the other great authority on the Quran, had the same reading, except that in his case, instead of having the word رَبَّكُمْ, he had رَبِّكَ. And so we find too that this changed expression, as it is recorded here, appears in one or two of the other secondary codices, the other manuscripts that existed. And in fact, Ibn Abi Dawud, in his book, the Kitab al-Masahif, page 61, as it's been printed, even goes further and says that Ibn Mas'ud read the word Sirat with the Arabic letter Sin, rather than the standard Sa'd. And so you find, as you go through these particular works, that there are numerous evidences and examples of different readings, variant readings, in the text of the Quran. I will give you another one. This time it comes from the manuscript of Ubay ibn Ka'b, which gives an example of the kind of distinction that you find between the different Quranic texts. This is Surah 5, verse 48, where the Quran says that we inscribe Allahim fiha, therein for them, meaning the Jews. But you find that the reading of Ubay ibn Ka'b was, وَأَنزَلَ اللَّهُ أَلَّا بَانِي إِسْرَائِيلَ فِيهَا, and we sent down to the children of Israel therein. So that you have a different expression entirely. It's basically the same, but the wording is very different. The rest of the text, in front and afterwards, remains exactly the same. And you can go on and on through these early records, and you'll find that there were different readings, different passages of the Quran held in one text that are omitted from another or written differently in another. And one can see why Uthman went to the drastic extent of ordering these various manuscripts to be burnt, because the distinctions between them were not minor. They were not confined to vowel points. They were not confined to pronunciations only, something I'll come to at the close of this talk. They were radical. They were very distinct. There were whole clauses that were different. You find also in certain parts of the hadith literature that whole passages of the Quran are said to be missing. In fact, you'll even find, for example, in one case, that the Khalif Umar, during his lifetime, claimed that a whole verse about adultery is now missing from the Quran as it stands. In the Quran today, in Surah 24 and verse 2, it says, the woman and the man guilty of adultery or fornication, flog each one of them with 100 stripes. But we find that Umar once stated, and this is recorded in almost all the works of hadith literature, in the Sirah literature as well, Ibn Ishaq's Sirah Rasulullah, Sahih of al-Bukhari, I'll quote it from the second text, from volume 8, page 539. Umar sat on the pulpit one day in a mosque, I think must have been the major one in Medina, and said when the people had finished the prayer call, Umar stood up and, having glorified and praised Allah as he deserved, he said, I am going to tell you something which Allah has written for me to say. I do not know, perhaps it portends my death. Whoever understands and remembers it must tell it to the others wherever his mount takes him. But if somebody is afraid that he does not understand it, then it's unlawful for him to tell lies about me. So you can see from this that Umar was very concerned that what he was about to say would not be taken either lightly or favorably. And his attitude was, what I want to tell you, you may not like, but none of you must dare say that I haven't said this. And what he said is now recorded in the Sirah Rasulullah, in the English translation that we have, page 684. God sent Muhammad, he said, and he sent down the scripture to him, meaning the Quran. Part of what he sent down was the passage on stoning, meaning that people who committed adultery, married men and married women, should be stoned to death. He said, the apostle stoned, and we stoned after him. I fear that in time to come men will say they find no mention of stoning in God's book and thereby go astray in neglecting an ordinance which God has sent down. Truly, he said, stoning in the Kitabullah, in the book of Allah, is a penalty laid on married women and men who commit adultery. In other records, in the Muwatta of Imam Malik, in the English translation, page 352, the verse is said to have read, the adult men and women who commit adultery, stone them. And it's well known that this practice of stoning adulterers has continued as part of the Sunnah of Islam even down to the present day. And this is where it comes from. There are numerous records in the hadith literature that tell us that during the lifetime of Muhammad, he did precisely this. He stoned people to death who were guilty of adultery. So you have a contradiction between what Umar says here and what is actually written in the Quran today. But Umar was quite persuaded that this verse belonged in the Quran, and in fact, the various early writers of Islamic tradition, particularly Abu Ubaid again, actually have passages where they say that the original text of the Quran of Surah Al-Baqarah used to be the same length as a later surah in which was the verse of stoning. Ubay ibn Ka'b, in the tradition I'm actually quoting, that's recorded in Abu Ubaid's work, said to me, Uzair, how many verses did you count in Surah Al-Ahzab? 72 or 73, I answered. But he said to me, it used to be equal to Surah Al-Baqarah, and we used to read in it the verse of stoning. So I said, what is the verse of stoning? He said, if a grown man and woman commit adultery, stone them without hesitation as a warning from Allah, for Allah is mighty and wise. And there are numerous other instances. I'm just giving these as brief examples. Numerous other records of variant readings of a substantial type that made Uthman take this seriously enough to order that the other manuscripts of the Quran that were in existence should be burnt. The idea was that the confusion or the differences, the divisions might grow further and further until the standard text of the Quran was in fact lost completely. And so his aim when he ordered these other texts to be burnt was not to establish Zayd's text as the sole authoritative text because he believed it was perfect, but simply to get uniformity. That's what early Islamic tradition said. A Mus'haf Wahid, that was his objective. A single manuscript, a single written text of the Quran for the whole Muslim community. The aim was literally to stop the division and confusion regarding the Quran going even further still and to preserve what was there. But now I come to a key Muslim argument. Whenever Muslims hear of these traditions, whenever they are confronted with these records in the early traditional literature of Islam, they say it could not have been major differences that existed. There must be something else. There must be other differences that existed. They couldn't have been so serious. And the argument goes, and one reads this in so many Muslim writings today, that the differences were only in pronunciation. They were only in qira'at, in recitation, because there were, although Arabic was spoken as the common language of the Hijaz, there were different dialects, different lughat, that existed in that area, and they say that all that was happening here was simply that some of them read the Quran one way and others read the Quran another way, and the end result was just that the different dialects were confusing people, and so Uthman decided simply to standardize one dialect. And even there, the average Muslim might say to himself, but that still sounds as though there were some differences. But they turn, the Muslim writers, to a tradition recorded in Sahih of al-Bukhari, volume 6, page 510, where we read these words. The Quran has been revealed to be recited in seven different ways, so recite of it that which is easier for you. And that text comes out of an incident in Muhammad's lifetime where Muhammad himself was actually confronted by Umar and another companion, and they were reading the Quran differently. And Umar said, this man doesn't read it as I read it. And so Muhammad said to the companion, read the text that was in dispute, and he read it. And then he said to Umar, you read it. And he read it differently. And Muhammad said, you're both right. And they said, but how can this be? And he said, no, the Quran was revealed to be recited in seven different ways. Sub'ati Ahruf is the expression used in Arabic. The seven different readings. And recite whichever one is easier for you. And so Muslims say today, that is what the different readings were. They were purely in pronunciation, just different dialects. There were seven of them. They were all authorized by Allah. So there's no change, no division. Nothing of the Quran has been changed or lost. But if one looks at this carefully, you find that that tradition about the seven different readings cannot possibly be applied to this record of the Quran's transmission as we have it. Firstly, when Uthman ordered the Quran to be written out, he did it in the way in which Arabic was written then. And in those days, the vowel points of Arabic, the fathah, the kasra, the dhamma as we know them, were not used in the written text. They only got into the text later. Originally, Arabic only had 17 consonants, not even the diacritical points that distinguish, as we would say in our alphabet, a B or an N or a T from one another. Not even those were used in the earliest texts. The text purely used 17 consonants, and whatever variations there were in pronunciation could not have been dealt with in the transmission of the Quran in the written form in which Uthman ordered it to be written out, simply because they were part of qiraat, recitation. See, Uthman was dealing with a thing which Arabic calls a mushaf, a text, a written manuscript. And that written manuscript could have one text, and yet it could be read in so many different ways because of the way in which you could use different vowel points. And many of the variant readings recorded in the Kitab al-Masahif, particularly some of the hadith works on the different dialects that existed in Abu Dawud's records. Abu Dawud, in the Kitab al-Sunan that he wrote, there's a whole chapter given just to differences in dialect and slight variations in meaning in some Quran texts. These were to do with qira'ah, pronunciation, recitation. And you can't burn what a man says or how he pronounces something. You can only burn something that's written. And the reason why these Quran texts were ordered to be burnt was because what was written varied in the various texts. And what was written there was substantially different, as we've seen in many cases, between one manuscript and the other. And even then, if one looks into the records of the early hadith and other literature of Islam, one says, but wait a minute, what exactly or were these seven different readings? How do we find them recorded in early Islam? In fact, you don't. You have to go to the year 322, as we know today, Anno Hijra, which means in the year after Muhammad's immigration to Medina. 300 years after Muhammad's life, to find anyone dealing with the text about the seven different readings. And that was a theologian by the name of Ibn Mujahid, who was one of the leading theologians in the Abbasid government of the day at Baghdad. And this man decided to do away with the wide variety of pronunciations and dialects that there still were of the Quran in his time. When Uthman ordered those other manuscripts to be burnt, he couldn't deal with the differences in pronunciation. And it was this man, Ibn Mujahid, who had considerable influence with the wazirs of his day, that said, let us prescribe only seven of them as the acceptable readings according to that tradition of Muhammad. And so, like Zayd before him, but even more according to his own discretion, he chose what he felt were the seven best readings of the Quran in terms of pronunciation and dialect. And he imposed those readings on the Muslim world from the Abbasid seat of government and said no others will be allowed. And so, like the original standardizing of the written text, now the qira'ah of the Quran also became standardized into seven different forms. Only two of those forms have survived to the present day, the reading of Hafs and the reading of Warsh. The reading of Warsh survived only in parts of the Maghrib, of North Africa, Morocco, Algeria. It's virtually died out. But every written, printed manuscript of the Quran today fully vocalized with vowel points, follows the reading of Hafs. They're all the same. We accept it. But not because they were originally the same, but simply because the Quran has been, as you can see, through a process of being standardized until it has come down to the form in which we have it today, where not only the written text in terms of the consonants has been standardized and is uniform, but even the pronunciation follows only one particular form. That's why you have a single text of the Quran today, but not because it was originally so. There's no way, going back into the early history of Islam and the Quran's development, that you can possibly tell what those original seven readings were supposed to be. Ask any Muslim theologian to write out seven different Qurans, fully vocalized, and say, these are what they were. These were the seven different readings. Even worse still, ask him to produce proof from the early records of Islam and the Quran as to how he gets that authority to say it was those seven. Not possible. That just became a convenient hadith to be used in later years to explain differences of reading. But as I said, differences of qira', of pronunciation, had nothing to do with the original order of Uthman to burn the manuscripts of his time. That had to do with vital differences of reading that you find between the manuscripts of his day. So let us close and let us have a look just briefly at the stages of the Quran's development. Firstly, during Muhammad's lifetime, it was loosely held in the memories of men, was written down on palms of dates, it was written down on stones and other materials. Nowhere was there anywhere where an exact, complete manuscript of the Quran existed. After Muhammad's death, during the reign of Abu Bakr, the first attempt was made to reduce the Quran to a single written form. Zayd ibn Thabit wrote out a manuscript of the Quran, but so did Ibn Mas'ud, so did Ubay ibn Ka'b, so did many others. By the time of Uthman, it was discovered that in the expanding Muslim world, the Quran was being read very differently in the various provinces, and it became apparent that vastly different readings, real variants in the text itself, existed throughout the Muslim world. And so Uthman gave an order to destroy all the other manuscripts in existence. None escaped the order. And he then transcribed Zayd's text and made that text alone the official text of the Quran. That was a standardizing process. That resolved the problem of the major differences between the texts. But the records of those differences survived. Then we find, though, that the qira', the recitation, the different forms of pronunciation survived Uthman's action, notwithstanding Muslim arguments that that was Uthman's purpose, was to do away with those different minor variants in pronunciation and just prescribe one text. No, quite the opposite. Those different readings, and there were more than seven different forms of them, survived. And various texts were read in various ways. There was no way you could confine it in seven different forms until Ibn Mujahid became a second Zayd, and he then became the redactor of one particular form of readings, and he allowed seven different aspects of it, and he said that is what the original text was intended to cover. But again, it was a man acting on his own discretion, not under divine supervision. And today, most of those readings have fallen into disuse, so that only one, the text of Hafs, prevails throughout the Muslim world today. If there is any difference between the Quran and the Bible in their textual history, the difference is simply that Christian scholars, in the interests of honesty and objective sincerity, preserved the variant readings that are in the Bible. Muslim scholars found it expedient rather to destroy them. The other big difference is that when one looks at the volume of them in each case, in the case of the Bible, you can only fill two or three pages with the variant readings that come out of a book that runs to 1,000 pages. The Quran is only one-fifth the length of the Bible. It came much later than the Bible. It was compiled over a period of 23 years, unlike the Bible, which was compiled over 2,000 years of history. And yet, when one would expect, therefore, naturally, that the transmission of the Quran should be more accurate to that than the Bible, you find that the variant readings that are known to have existed, as Arthur Jeffrey took them out of all these different works that I've been mentioning, fill no less than 400 pages. And that shows that the Muslims are not being entirely honest when they suggest that our Bible has been changed and that the Quran is word perfect. Rather, the textual authority of the Bible has a far better grounding than that of the Quran. The Quran has been standardized into the uniform text that we have today. It was not originally compiled in that form.